Coaching Inside the Box,
a youth soccer coaching podcast.
A Brit,
a Brazilian,
and an American
discuss culture and environment
and the impact it has on youth development.
Can you coach inside the box? Hello and welcome to another fantastic episode of Coaching Inside the Box, episode 62. And in this episode, we're going to get back to our roots at the core of why we developed and created and started recording the three of us Stooges talking together. We're going to really dive into culture and specifically the culture and the environment that has been perhaps in some respects over the last 5 to 10 years, one of the more perplexing, one of the more fascinating, one of the more interesting cultures to develop players and punch well above their weight. That's right. We're digging in and we're going to chat about Iceland. Andy, Philippe, how are you guys doing? Welcome back. Are you excited to talk about Iceland? Andy, is it good to get back to your Viking heritage? You should put the microphone up to your face. 62 episodes in, Andy is still a child when it comes to the technology that it takes to record these things.
That's actually quite a compliment. I'm not as intelligent as a child or competent as a child.
You know, so no, I mean like a baby, you know, one of the ones that's still, you know, pooing in their diaper.
Say baby, say what you mean.
They both wear diapers.
But with Andy, you can depend on him these days.
I've got to get to this joke first. You know, this is about a man driving.
Hosting a podcast with Andy is so difficult because you ask him a question
and he completely ignores the question.
He just goes wherever he wants to go. It's like I feel like I'm hosting a podcast with a bunch of cats.
I've coached you since you were.
And you asked me a question, but he's not going to give me the opportunity to answer the question either.
I can't believe, you know, I coached you since you were 5 or 6, all the way through. And after all those years of coaching and being together, you know, in the soccer coaching environment afterwards, you know, as under the same flag still the whole time, I can't believe you haven't realized that I ignore you as much as possible. I just can't believe it.
Didn't get the clue.
Let me tell this joke. So a man is driving in the remote wilderness of central Iceland and his car breaks down. After trying in vain to restart it, he got out, opened the hood, and started tinkering with the engine. He was about to give up hope when he heard a voice behind him. "That'll be your alternator. There's an uneven air gap between the rotor and stator, causing it to vibrate." To his horror, the man saw that it was a sheep talking. In terror, he ran back down the road he was driving on until he came to a small cottage. He banged on the door until the farmer inside opened it. After explaining what happened, the farmer raised an eyebrow and asked, "Was the sheep white with bulging eyes and only 3 legs? The driver admitted the sheep matched that description. "Oh, don't listen to that one," the farmer said. "He knows nothing about cars."
That's the joke?
Well, yeah. You know, okay. For people with a sense of humor, it's a good joke.
It's a good joke.
I did not understand that joke.
Well, you lost sleep at sheep.
I don't know how to tell it in Portuguese. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
It doesn't translate.
it's not going to be funny in any language.
Maybe in Icelandic. Maybe there's some rhyme we missed.
Anyway, I got a phone call this morning. My landlord wants to talk about my high heating bills. I told him my door is always open. I'm taking steps to overcome my hiking addiction, but I'm not out of the woods yet. Did you know that laughing out loud is forbidden in Hawaii? It's an aloha state.
I thought we were talking about Iceland.
No, that was just one joke.
Okay. Well, I mean, the episode today is about Iceland.
I told my wife she should embrace her mistakes.
There's no way you're going to read all that.
I told my wife she should embrace her mistakes. So she gave me a quick hug. How many do you want me to read?
All of them, Andy. All of them. I mean, judging by our late start to record today, because we were knee-deep in filming strategy, and the number of notes that are in front of you, I think it might be a good idea to transition now, Ant.
I like this one. You know,
let's do that. Yeah.
You get one more. You get one more.
Okay, I was going to tell you a joke about time travel, but you didn't like it.
That was actually good.
You have to be intelligent to laugh at that.
Good job, Andy.
I think my kids might laugh at that. I don't know. If you're looking for a soccer podcast with a smorgasbord array of dad jokes, this is the podcast for you.
Seriously.
Oh dear. All those hours of researching jokes, and that was all I got for that.
So let's set the stage properly before we dig into Iceland specifically. If you've listened to the episodes from the beginning, you've heard us talk about Iceland a little bit. You've heard us talk about France a little bit, specifically the suburbs of the Parisian suburbs. You've heard us talk about Ashington in great detail, which I still maintain is one of the best episodes in terms of content that we've done. It was one of the earlier episodes we did, so we certainly didn't know what we were doing then. But really, this podcast was largely born out of taking three different perspectives. We all grew up in the game differently. We all come from different cultures in terms of our youth, appreciating how culture and environment intersect with development and the impact that culture and environment have on development. And so I think for a long time, we've gotten away from doing an episode like this. And so I'm eager to kind of really dig in and look at, kind of like we used to, what Iceland has done from our vantage point, both from a research perspective, but also firsthand. Andy and I have both been to Iceland and have spent time wandering around those towns to look at the environment, what it looks like, and talking to people within the youth game to understand how they got where they did. So hopefully that's a bit of a context for those that maybe are new to this podcast and haven't gone back to the beginning and listened from there. Andy, I was going to ask a question, but you won't answer it anyway. So what would you like to speak about next?
Well, a little bit more background on Iceland. In the 2016 European Championship, their men's team reached the quarterfinals after, I'm not going to say who the opponents were, but they won 2-1 in the quarterfinals.
England.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for doing that.
I thought everybody should know.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. And Iceland, after beating England in the round of 16, got to the quarterfinals, so the last eight, and a lot of people don't realize this about Iceland. You know, it's 335,000 people live there.
Which, based on some research I was doing yesterday, the upper peninsula of Michigan, so that landmass that's connected to Wisconsin, right on the border, in the middle of a Great Lake, but right on the border of Canada, they have the same number of people. And the upper peninsula of Michigan has not produced soccer players anywhere near the level that Iceland has.
So now 335,000, actually I've got 375,000, so that, these stats are from when I first started researching this years ago. So Iceland is 180th in the population of the whole world. 180th. Digest that for a moment. You know, and it's a tiny fraction of most other countries that reach a World Cup quarterfinal. Tiny, tiny fraction. You know, and so between 1993 and 2023, Iceland's average FIFA men's ranking of all the world soccer playing nations was 62nd. Indeed, for two exceptional years, in 2016 and 17, Iceland's men ranked 21st and 22nd in all of the countries in the world, which is just incredible. Now, that's only the men, because the women have done a lot better than the men. So the women, between 2003 and 2023, the Icelandic women's team consistently ranked on average 18th to 19th globally on average. Now, think about that for a moment. You know, you've got, they're 183rd in population, and yet they're ranked consistently 18th to 19th on average of all the world's countries, And it's interesting to note that the next smallest country to have previously reached the Men's World Cup finals was Trinidad and Tobago in 2006. However, TNT had more than four times Iceland's population, 1.3 million people, and a much easier qualifying schedule because they were in CONCACAF. They weren't in the European.
Blasphemy. CONCACAF is tough.
On which world is CONCACAF tough? On Mars? Where it's, you know, it would be
the only Solomon one? Island, right?
And Solomon Islands is not in CONCACAF, Philippe.
And Antigua?
Good effort at flexing there.
Not flexing, I'm making fun of the CONCACAF.
You know, anyway, moving swiftly on, there's got to be something unique about Icelandic soccer, right?
For 100%.
You know, if they're punching above their weight to such a degree.
And it's not a traditional soccer society. It's not one that's steeped in the professional game or was at the inception of the birth of the game.
So, you know, back when, you know, we were on our way to, you know, go and watch the Women's World Cup in Paris, you and I, we both stopped off in Iceland and then did our own thing, different things. Yep. You know, and you know, I met with, and I'm probably going to murder this, but Haraldur, Halley is his nickname, Hrod Marson, a coach at Valur and Akranes soccer clubs, you know, during his career. And he helped me understand the special sauce that has propelled Iceland, a country that should be a soccer underdog, to challenge and triumph over soccer's giants. And his insight was refreshing because, you know, he said winning is not the sole focus in Iceland. You know, it's less of a focus, he feels, than it is in the rest of the world. You know, and he said that, you know, they have an emphasis on skillful competition that values tomorrow over today, that values development over immediate statistical results. You know, and he said that also Icelanders are tough. It's a rock in the middle of the Atlantic. You know, it's freezing cold most of the time, hence the name. It's a big clue. You know, but the communal way of living in Iceland over the centuries has created a very egalitarian, fair-minded society that's less ego-based than most societies. So creative individualism is not encouraged. So now this is interesting because we're all about creative individualism, right? But this isn't encouraged where they are because, you know, they're about being fair and sharing the ball more, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Collectivism is a characteristic that permeates their entire society.
Right. You know, he said that street credibility comes from not letting your teammates down and being responsible and fair, from being honest while competing. Showing off is avoided. That's his quote. And Brian Blickenstaff from Vice Sports puts it best. This is a team from a rock in the North Atlantic occupying the same latitudes as Central Alaska. Think about that for a minute. It's so barren and hard to reach that humans didn't settle it until 874. I mean, it's called Iceland, for God's sake. There's no bad odds in Iceland. Bad odds are called life. Here you live and thrive through careful planning and execution and hard, hard work. Or you don't live at all. So they don't have a creative culture. So, you know, we're not using this as a promotion for our culture of creativity, you know, which we still believe in 110%, despite Iceland's success, not using our culture. So what is it about Iceland that allowed them to be that competitive in world soccer if they don't have a creative culture?
A focus on tomorrow. A development over everything else. And I think it largely has to do with, and this has been written about at some length, but it's certainly something that I think you and I, Andy, saw in person, was this embracing of small-sided games and this collective nature of creating a culture where kids are playing so often in really small, tight, largely walled spaces. And I think that was a big piece of it. That's not the answer maybe you were looking for.
Well, yeah, it's all tied into that, you know. And so, you know, the interesting thing is I went from poking around, you know, the neighborhoods of Iceland and looking at, you know, everything I could while I was there to flying to Paris for the World Cup, the Women's World Cup, you know, and there I poked around, you know, the neighborhoods of Paris that produced the great players,
yep,
you know, that helped France win the World Cup, you know, and so, you know, I had this incredible change in perspective from, you know, a very, very cold culture, you know, and into a somewhat, you know, more moderate climate culture in Paris, you know, and but a very different attitude towards the game, because in the suburbs of Paris, it was like being in inner city basketball. It was like this, you know, this street cred came from being creative, from beating people with a dribble, from scoring, you know, funky dunks,
yeah,
you know, from, you know, doing the most amazing things, draining three pointers from, you know, downtown Charlie Brown, you know, all this stuff, you know, and so it was the opposite in the suburbs of Paris. It was all about showing off. It was all about impressing the girls, you know, getting a date, you know, and so that was the attitude that produced, you know, Kylian Mbappe, you know, comes from that attitude, you know, in Bromby, you know, in the suburbs of Paris, you know, and you know, so all of the great players that earned France the World Cup, and it was well deserved, you know, came from, you know, these small-sided, you know, communities, so they had this head start, so they got picked up by professional academies, you know, who then, you know, managed to retain enough of the creativity that the French team across the board was pretty darn creative compared to any team they played against. And they had such a massive percentage of immigrants on that team. It was just unbelievable how many, you know, people were of immigrant extraction where they just grew up playing street soccer, whether that was in their new communities in France or their original communities in mostly Africa. You know, so, you know, we had that, you know, that basketball-like show-off street cred culture that gave France the ability to win a World Cup. But in Iceland, there was none of that culture. There was none of that, I'm going to take you on, I'm going to beat you to the move. You know, but here's where the similarities between the two cultures come into play. What did Iceland have that the suburbs of Paris also had?
Small, tight.
The fields, small fields.
Yeah, small, tight spaces.
Yeah, they, you know, all over the suburbs of Paris, you know, at the base of these apartment complexes, was frankly pretty ugly living, high-rise living for the kids and the families. You know, they were able to take an elevator or take the stairs and come down to the bottom of this high-rise and walk outside the front door, and there was a 4-on-4, 3-on-3, 5-on-5, whatever, practice field, boarded, where the ball couldn't escape, where they could, you know, to their heart's content, bang a ball against a wall if they wanted to go out there and do that, or join in with the neighborhood kids and play small-sided games, play micro-soccer, play in the goal mouth, play between, you know, in most instances, the penalty spot and the goal, you know, talking about a typical outdoor penalty spot of 12 yards, you know, and that's where angels fear to tread. That's where you develop incredible ability to play this game on the edge of chaos, you know, because your facilities force you to do it, you know, and we're doing the total opposite here in America, you know. And so, you know, why did Paris come to build all these fields? It was all about social control. It was all about stopping the riots that were occurring, you know, where the immigrants who were downtrodden and being paid probably less than they deserved, you know, couldn't even support their families. You know, so, they, you know, they put all of these facilities in order to give, you know, these people a better quality of living, you know, and stop the youth from rioting and causing riots. If they're playing soccer, they can't riot, right? In Iceland, they had a similar problem because Iceland realized it had to address the drink and drug culture that was corrupt in its youth. And its leaders seized upon sport and primarily soccer to reroute young people onto a better path of fitness and positive goal-oriented activity. So, and here's where the advantages of only having at the time 330,000 population and a close-knit social ethos come into play. Because it resulted in one of the great success stories of the modern societal era. Because flush with money that came with Iceland's success as an offshore investment haven, you know, and determined to save its children from the evils of alcohol and chemical substance abuse, the Icelandic government and population built indoor sports halls in nearly every community on the island. And anywhere there was a school, they built a sports hall gymnasium. Well, they already had one because it was a school. And they added a boarded mini field on government property. On the grounds of the school, they put in a boarded 3-on-3, 4-on-4, 5-on-5 field where the ball, if you smashed it, would come back at you off of the surrounding boards around the goal or the side of the field. So you didn't have to chase the ball very often. Obviously, once in a while, you'd sky it and you had to go get a ball. You know, but you know, most of the time, it was rebounded and you could just go again and go again and go again. So you know, they then followed this by putting in the biggest communities in Iceland, they put in 14 either half-size or full-size soccer fields for the whole community to come in every night and practice it. But because these fields were for the whole community, and you know, you got the prime hours of between 5 and 8, those fields were divided up into, you know, 8, 10, 12 mini fields. You know, so it was all 3-on-3, 4-on-4, 5-on-5, and once again, it was all micro soccer in the goal mouth. You know, so you know, and Iceland had a boom in soccer because of these outdoor fields, because the gymnasiums were open in the evenings, because of these indoor fields in the communities. And then they took out all the grass playing pitches nationwide and they put in underground heating in any decent sized community. So the actual soccer field that was the stadium field for the local semi-pro or pro team in the community became a year-round usable field. So all of a sudden now, in the middle, in the heart of these neighborhoods, and people brought up in cities in America can't even imagine how tiny some of these hamlets are in Iceland. They are tiny, tiny villages, you know, with ostensibly a population of 30 or 40 people, you know, but surrounding that area, there's lots of individual homes and houses, you know, that might be a mile outside town or 2 miles outside town. All of these areas in Iceland now had all of these things that were available to them, you know, and, you know, the government completely turned the ship around. It was an oil tanker going in the wrong direction. You know, drink, drugs, alcohol, you know, all the things that, you know, that have plagued, you know, the you know, weaker societies or the weaker area of societies since, you know, everything was invented. And they turned it around and made it almost, you know, drug-free, you know, and, you know, and they replaced for the family the temptations of losing your mind through, you know, substances, you know, with really powerful connection through the sport of soccer, you know, by literally making sure that the sun always shined on Icelandic soccer. Make sense?
Yeah. One thing that's interesting, and we'll share some photos and maybe some videos of both our experience in France and in Iceland. Andy, there's a photo I believe you took, but I saw it in real life in these small villages. The outdoor boarded space that they used for playing, it was almost like a court that you would see in South America, or you would see throughout Europe, right? But it was almost a court-like setup with these boards, this lumber built around it that you could see through, that created this small, a little bit smaller than a basketball court, playing surface that kids would go and play at during the warmer months of the year in Iceland. And that juxtaposed, and what was so interesting about it is, like, this is, as we've just talked about, a town of hardly anybody, and they have like the best playing surface and environment that could exist, and it was this concerted effort to change to change the way that kids lived and spent their time that started many years before 2016, but culminated in the purple patch, the golden generation of Icelandic football, punching so far above their weight.
It was just amazing. We were traveling to see, you know, this amazing, you know, a point where a glacier meets the sea, you know, and, you know, it's called Diamond Bay because, you know, as it calves, you know, the ice becomes, you know, little diamond-sized chunks that float around the bay before they finally, you know, reduce in size enough to escape through the channel to the ocean, you know, but on a sunny day, you know, it all looks like 1,000 diamonds in the bay, you know, so we're way outside of Reykjavik on the way to this you know, this wonderful tourist, you know, opportunity, you know, and we pull into this little coastal town with no more than I don't know, 30, 40 houses, you know, and we're right on the edge of this, you know, this coastal town, and I see this school and I see this field, you know, and there's nothing around it. There's school on one side and nothing on the other three sides, you know. And what happens though is all of the kids from the surrounding communities inland a little way, you know, are brought into the school during the day, you know, and then, you know, they play on this field during recess, you know, and a lot of times they play stay and play in the, and they recreate in the community, and they use this field for hours after school is over, you know, either the gym or the field, you know, when the weather's nice enough, you know. And so, you know, I go out on the field and there's nothing around me. You know, it's just amazing, apart from the school that sat on the one side of it. It's just it's like a middle primary school, you know. And, you know, I'm looking at this and I'm saying, you know, wow. You know, they've, you know, been so forward thinking that they're catering to all of these kids' physical education needs, you know, by putting this here so that they don't just come for the school day. You know, they stay after school and they recreate after school for an hour or two, and it's all in the same place.
Perhaps my favorite thing about examining Iceland is, you know, Philippe, we spend so much time talking about Brazil. We spend so much time talking about your youth growing up with a court, a field at the base of the apartment or the condo complex that you lived in, right? And that's where kids spent their time. And like, we talk about this all the time, and I think collectively as a soccer community, we often talk about street soccer and all of those things. And I've said this before numerous times on this podcast, but you know, the solution to taking American soccer to the next level does not exist within, let's just send our kids to the streets in downtown Kansas City and tell them we'll pick them up in 2 hours and find a game to play in. We have to create the environment in a way that fits with our culture, right? And so we've talked about this on previous episodes, that the facilities that we've built, right? Now we have, four in Kansas City, is that right? Four, yep. In Kansas City, you know, spread all across Kansas City so that kids can go to these facilities and get small-sided micro soccer opportunities that developmentally have a lot of parallels to the places that Philippe grew up in Brazil playing, right? That the Parisian suburbs that Kylian Mbappe ended up playing. And what's cool is that Iceland has taken that they don't have urban centers for this environment. So they've taken those environments and made them work for their culture, and you've seen them ascend to a level that you never would have guessed.
Well, and I think it's
Philip,
really.
Can I jump in? Hold that thought, because you abused me at the start of this podcast, right? You
know, every episode, yeah.
Right, and you just had, you struggled to remember four facilities that we had in Kansas City. You were like 1, 2, 3, 4, thinking, counting in your
head.
Well,
we keep adding them.
Okay, yeah, four, right? You know, it's not like it's 44.
It was three months ago.
You know, you looked up at the ceiling, and you're in your mind, you were doing a calculation to get to four.
I think a previous episode recently, I said three, and you guys corrected me, so I didn't want to be wrong again. Philippe, what were you going to say?
No, I think what's really interesting is, if you think about it, Iceland didn't plan to create the perfect environment for these kids. It just happened naturally, right? They saw the necessity of thinking of a solution for a problem.
There was a need, yeah.
Yeah, and then they...
And they had the money.
And they had the money. And why small fields? Well, small population. They didn't need to put big fields because they did have the space,
yeah.
Right? So
yeah.
If there were more people, they would probably have put big complexes, big artificial.
That's a good point.
So it was luck, right? Necessity of being indoors a lot of times because of the cold. Indoors, you need walls, you need to be covered, you need surroundings. So that might be an aspect of a luck there as well. You look in South America, and probably in the suburbs of Paris, you know, and other countries in Europe. Why there are so many courts, so many fields in Brazil, so many projects in the favelas? Because most of the population is poor, and these kids at age 10 are being, you know, asked to, you know, join the crime, right? And it's the easy way to get out of poverty is through crime, or the other opportunity is soccer. So it's a necessity for the countries there, right, to put as many fields, as many available, and there's no space, right? because that's a big population, but there's no space. So it has to be small, right? So they're really small everywhere, right? So it all, it's not, the government, the president's like, that doesn't know anything about soccer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's not going to make decisions about what's better for development, repetition. It's just what happens naturally. The U.S. doesn't have the need, doesn't have any social, economical, political need for the kids, you know, to save from poverty, for save from crime, for alcohol and all that. Maybe, you know, obesity or something like that.
I'm going to push back a little bit there. I see your point is right in terms of like soccer is not one that's played by kids in low demographics in the United States. And so the need to get out, soccer is not seen or
it actually is in the Hispanic community and a little refugees bit, yeah, communities, yeah. And it happens. It's starting to happen. But my point is, it's not gonna come organically to the U.S. because the need is not there. It has to come from people like us building these places and more importantly, making it accessible for kids.
I think what you've pointed out is like a really interesting thought, and maybe Andy's already been there and I'm just the slow one to get here, but as you just pointed out, Brazil or South America, right, they built small fields because that's the only, like, they can only build small fields. Iceland had the money, right, to build whatever they wanted, and they chose small fields because their population is so small. That was the only thing that makes it, like, presumably that was the only thing that made sense. It's like, I know we can gather six kids around on an ongoing basis. If we build an 11v11 pitch, they're just going to go sit in a corner and play 6v6, for example. Mm-hmm. Or they've got so many kids in those big indoor halls that Andy just described that they got to divide them up into small spaces. So
because
it's fulfilling the
need
because of the age, right? But in the United States, we have the land. We have plenty of land. We've got
plenty of money,
right? And so what do? And we have plenty of population. We have plenty of kids playing. What do? We just go build a bunch of big fields, and then we just like throw a new sponsor tag and build some more big fields, right? And because we have we're glutton for all of those luxuries. We don't have the need to build the small fields, and that's at its core.
And then what happens to the price of your soccer?
It goes, yeah, because it's a business, sure. Yeah.
Well, and the reason that we build all these big complexes is because the local government sees a way to fill hotels and restaurants and you know, by running tournaments on weekends, you know, and we used to run these tournaments. We were the ones that actually probably kicked off this massive growth because, you know, we started the Mid-America Soccer Association and had 11 tournaments over 12 weekends, you know, and you know, we brought, you know, hundreds of thousands of people into South Kansas City, you know, to compete in our tournaments. And we created this, you know, this traveling band of people that led to a boom in facilities, you know, because we had terrible tournament facilities. We were good at promoting our tournaments, you know, and eventually the facilities caught up. But it was only because there was money involved and people could profiteer out of these people coming in on weekends, you know, because for 12, 13 weekends in the year, they could guarantee a sellout because of the soccer tournaments, you know. So it's interesting. Let's get back to Iceland, because we're missing out on a huge part of Iceland, which is the female game. You know, and this tends to get neglected in so many perspectives on soccer. And Iceland have achieved more relative success on the international footballing stage than their male counterparts, but more relative success on the international football stage than any country in world history by a factor of 1,000 to 1. It's just ridiculous what the Icelandic women have achieved with such a tiny population. But, you know, is it a coincidence that Iceland is ranked number one in the world for gender equality? You think that's a coincidence?
Definitely not.
You know, so in Iceland, the women are regarded as more equal than anywhere else on the rest of the planet. So, you know, they get included in everything to do with soccer, you know, to an equal degree to the guys. And they have been now for decades, ever since the facilities started growing. You know, it's they've been included with all of the boys' stuff. If a girl is good enough to play with the boys, they play with the boys. There's no restrictions. That's welcome. That's wanted. That's part of their culture. And people get called out if they don't do it. You know, here, it's on, a lot of people don't even have that on their radar in the U.S. You know, it's not even thought about that girls should be able to play with the boys. You go to any one of these big outdoor complexes and watch any one of our competitors, you will almost never see a girl playing with a boys' team. Almost never. You know, it's a complete barrier, the gender barrier. You know, in Iceland, you go into these field houses and you see girls intermingled in everything that these clubs, these societies, these microcosms of societies are doing. You know, the girls are intermingled in there like you wouldn't believe. I went to this club and I met with Hallie, you know, in Reykjavik, you know, and they were running a camp operation during the summer when I visited. And the girls and the boys, it was like they were one sex and there was no division. They were all in multiple mini fields during this camp of girls and boys all intermingled. You know, and we walked through it and he said, look, this is a really good player. So she's playing up 2 years with the boys. You know, where has that ever happened? You know, so this girl, you know, grew up playing with the boys because she loved it. She was there every day and she became a really good player. You know, and there was no barrier to her getting what she needed in terms of the level of competition, you know, with the people she needed to be competing with. You know, and it was almost like everybody was asexual. Nobody had a gender identity, you know, because it was all about what you can do and where you need to be for your own development. It wasn't about whether you had long hair and a ponytail. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
We don't do that over here.
No. I mean, you do see girls playing with boys some, but
it's rare.
But it's and perhaps it's born out of a need from I mean, of
I
course it's born
say,
out of a need, right?
It's like, usually when the girl it's first of all grown up a lot more than the boys and she's really 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 good and then to a certain age she can really impact the game and then the coaches are like, oh okay, she's gonna win me games, so I'm gonna put her there. So it's more of a egotistical, you know, stats thing than actually, you know, doing something.
We're making a mistake. Even in our club we're making a mistake because we're not actually bringing the girls up playing with the boys so that happens more.
Mm-hmm.
We are waiting until it happens, and then we're including the girl in the boys,
mm-hmm.
which makes us exceptional because other clubs don't even do that, you know. But we can change our philosophy, you know, and we can become fairer, you know, and lose our gender bias, you know, lose those glasses that we're wearing that divide those, you know, different genders up into automatically two separate and distinct, you know, classes of player, you know, and... You know, for, you know, the last, you know, I haven't been coaching now for a couple of years, but the last few years I was coaching my daughter, Holly. And
they train with the boys often.
They train together all the time. Yeah. I was coaching her team as well. I was coaching my stepson's team, Jake's team. And then they were the same age, Jake and Holly. And, you know, and I practiced those two teams together all the time, you know, and everybody got massively better. It didn't retard the boys' development, you know, it accelerated the girls' development, you know, and these girls and boys became firm friends. When they see each other today, they're buddies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's not this, they're girls, we're boys, and, you know, all the crap that comes with that. They're just friends. You know, they see each other, they walk up to each other, you know, they give each other a big hug, you know, and they're just buddies. Because they played together for so long, they see each other just as people, you know, and it was a beautiful thing to witness, you know, and that changed my whole perspective after all those years of separating the girls and the boys, because, you know, if you do that, both the girls and the boys lose an opportunity. As long as you're keeping the girls and the boys at the same ability level, there's nothing to lose by throwing them all in there together and having them all constantly in this morass playing these small-sided games, you know, one-on-one, two-on-two, three-on-three, you know, where you mix them all up and teams are just chosen based on ability,
yeah,
round by round, you know, and you mix them all up and they just go and they have to play one touch, two touch, fake a move within two. They have to do all the things that we believe in and play this incredible creative game in micro soccer in front of the goal in goal mouth spaces. But now you don't subdivide the genders and you get brilliance on both sides. Make sense?
It makes total sense. When you, Andy, when you've looked at Iceland or when you spoke with Holly in Iceland, did anything stick out related specifically to the coaching, like who coaches? Is there strong rigidity between like professional level players being involved in the youth games, everything from that perspective, or is it still pretty collective in nature from a cultural perspective to the way that Icelandic football is developed?
So, and this is a really interesting, you know, aspect of Icelandic culture, is they attribute a lot of their success to the fact that they have more FIFA-registered coaches for their size, everything's relative, than any other country in the world. Per capita, they have registered more coaches, male and female. You know, there's, once again, it's an egalitarian society, so, you know, it's not, you know, way more men than women. It's probably closer than any other country in the world to equal representations between the sexes, as far as coaches go, not just players. You know, so this is really interesting about the Icelandic culture, you know, but we've talked about this before. I think trained coaches are a negative if we're talking about the general way in which federations across the world train their coaches, because they train passing first. And we've talked about Stephen Covey, we've talked about Abraham Maslow, which we're going to get into in future episodes, mm-hmm. You know, because I've been just, you know, doing some more research and writing even more about, you know, these two geniuses, you know, and what the world is not doing is learning from these geniuses and recognizing that we need to be independent first before we can truly be brilliantly interdependent, you know, and so coaches, by their very nature, they start working on team. They get kids together and they start working on team. And individual creativity, like, you know, what happens in Brazil's favelas or the Paris suburbs, you know, traditionally that goes out of the window when coaches get involved. And here's the crazy thing. Coaches change their practice scenarios drastically from week to week to week. So they'll have this idea is now I need to be working on, you know, this type of pattern play. And then 2 weeks later, you go to their practice, and they're working on a completely different type of pattern play. And there's no way their players could have gotten even close to learning the pattern play that they did 2 weeks ago. And so all you've got is you've got this confused coach that thinks that they're doing an intelligent coaching thing by varying their practices big time week to week, instead of doing what we do in our educational system, which is we build upon topics. We gradually add complications, you know, to whatever topic it is, a historical topic, a scientific topic, a language topic. We build complications into the topic, and gradually, because of a whole curriculum, we're laying in piece by piece a greater degree of difficulty, which is what we do in the Legends Clubs. You know, we layer in an extra degree of difficulty, but we're first and foremost building great independence, great dribblers and goal scorers. You notice you're not passing to anybody when you score a goal. That's an end to the whole move. That's the objective. So you are not a team player when you're scoring a goal. You're a hero, right? You know, and when you're dribbling the ball, you're not a team player. When you're beating people 1, 2, 3 at a time, you're not passing the ball. You know, and in Iceland, they don't have a dribbling culture. They've got lots of coaches, and I would suggest that their coaches are not really good at coaching tremendous individuality, because the society is so egalitarian. You know, it's so equal. All right, that anybody that goes out there and does this show-off thing, and this is what Hallie said to me, they're instantly disrespected because they're not equal. They don't want to be equal. They want to be better. And those people are pulled back. And this is what you have to deal with as a society. If you pull back your geniuses, instead of bringing the rest of society up, you dumb down the effect. And this is what's happening in Icelandic men's soccer big time right now, is they are gradually sliding back down the scales. And I'm not saying they'll ever be 182nd, which is where their population would have them be if we're just looking at it statistically. But they're gradually sliding back to 60th, 70th, 80th in the world rankings, which is still amazing considering that they're 182nd in population. But they're sliding back because they don't have that creativity, you know. And we got to remember their success was built a lot on toughness, you know. And that toughness is disappearing. And why is it disappearing?
I mean, I pray it's the general how society is moving across the entire world. Would be my assumption, right? We're becoming technologically advanced, which is having a negative impact on toughness. I don't know the answer that you're looking for. That's my guess. Cell phones, yeah. So that's kind of what I said.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And I think that's the key. I think, like we were talking about, they have the right environment, but they don't have the right philosophy and culture. And I think that's what makes the whole difference. You know, it's letting the kid, like Andy said, you gotta let your geniuses flourish. Otherwise, they, you know, you leveled the society, the team, the soccer, everything, you know, at the bottom. And when you have somebody that is super special, you know, especially, you know, on a soccer environment, you know, I'm thinking of every team. If there's somebody much better than me, I'm pushing myself to be better than him. And that elevates the level for everybody, right? So, but yeah, I mean, you look at the countries that are usually more successful in the game, and there are countries that, you know, have the creativity, have the culture. You know, they have the creative players. I mean, we've talked about that so often, and, you know, we can't stress it enough. You know, you even look at the Italian teams that won. Those were the Italian teams that had individually the best players. You know, and Italy has been always talked about as the country that is organized and defend and tough and all that. But the teams, all the time they won World Cups, they had one or two guys that were generational talents, you know, and that just proves the point of everything.
So
as Germany.
What we've got to look at when we're deciding on our culture, you know, when we're deciding on, you know, our design, our environment, you know, when we're deciding on our philosophy, when we're deciding how to influence these kids beyond soccer,
sure.
What we've got to look at is all of these societies that have made mistakes, you know, and, you know, have come up with answers to the mistakes that they've made, like Iceland, you know, and the drink and drug culture, and then the banking money that came in, you know, and they've done wonderful things. Now, you know, they're falling prey to social media, and their kids are becoming lethargic and lazy, you know, and we're seeing it with the younger generation all over the world. You know, this is happening in Brazil now. You know, so, you know, the kids are becoming lethargic and lazy. They don't go out and play in the streets as much. You know, and so now you've got a dumbing down of the Brazilian culture, and the academies are growing, and coaching influence is growing. So kids get pulled out of the street culture, as you've pointed out in the past, Philippe, you know, into this academy culture, and the coach thinks he's a genius, you know, and starts working on pattern plays, you know, and all of a sudden you're losing your Neymars. They're not coming out of the Brazilian favelas, you know, and we're hoping that, you know, that the guys that occasionally do something that somewhat looked like a Neymar or Pelé, we're hoping that they can fill the gap in Brazilian culture. And it's not happening. You know, and Iceland, you know, it's not happening now. And the women are going to slide eventually because of this lazy social media culture. You know, they're not out there playing with the guys as much as they used to, because now they're spending an extra 30 minutes or an hour on the phone, where they used to be in these field houses, they used to be in these on these small fields outside of the schools, you know, hitting shots and, you know, and doing things for hours, and now they're spending that time watching Instagram reels, you know, or TikTok reels, you know, and so now that time is wasted, and physiologically they're worse off, more medical problems, you know, and psychologically, you know, my wife is studying to be a nurse practitioner because there's a massive problem now with teenagers. You know, so she's within a year of getting her nurse practitioner qualification in psych, and she wants to work with adolescents because there's an epidemic of especially young female problems, you know, that's happening as a result of what's going on with social media in our society, you know, and people are looking so inwards, they're not developing the character that playing small-sided soccer games, you know, and learning to fight and battle and scrap and be skillful and be healthy, you know, and having peer respect and being all in it together without any gender divisions, they're not doing that stuff. And so we've got this opportunity, and we're doing this with the Legends Club, you know, to do all of these things to take out the gender divisions, you know, to make everything small-sided, you know, to make kids really special, to give them the ability to beat people in a one-on-one that the Icelandic kids don't have because of their egalitarian culture. So we've got to take the best and we've got to lose the worst of all of these cultures. You know, and Iceland has done an incredible job, you know, of negating the impact of their, you know, their freezing cold culture, you know, climatic conditions, bringing it all indoors and creating this super competitive, you know, international phenom situation. But they're not going any further. They're starting to sink. They're starting to slide because they don't have the creativity. And this is a problem because we're not getting to, you know, the high level of interdependence stage that Stephen Covey espoused in the Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. We're not getting to the transcendent stage that Abraham Maslow espouses in his hierarchy of needs. You know, and this is the crazy. In fact, we're not even getting to the self-actualization phase that Maslow espoused in the hierarchy of needs because we're focusing on team. You know, give it away, give it away, give it away. And that's not the way it works in society. Kids are individually, selfishly motivated to learn incredible things. You know, and then we bring them into society and we say, no, you can't be an individual anymore. And we take these geniuses, you know, that, you know, are just open books for learning at age, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. By the time they're 15, we've corridored them and we've taken their passion out of learning, you know, and this is a real problem. It's happening to Iceland, you know, and they're losing the very thing that made them special because they're so fair, they're so equal, they can't allow their kids to be a great dribbler and goal scorer. You know, it's a real problem. So, you know, even though they might have a physical specimen as good as Erling Haaland, they're not going to be encouraged just to take the ball and go with it and score goal after goal after goal, because that's not the way our Icelandic culture is. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm following.
Yeah, so, you know, and this is what we've got to be aware of. We've got to be aware of, you know, where the bullet holes are. You know, we talked a little bit about Abraham Wald, you know, and when the airplanes came back from, you know, from action in the Second World War, you know, the researchers looked at the planes that came back and said, where are the bullet holes? Because we need to put reinforcement there. And they totally looked at it with the wrong perspective, because you don't put, you know, reinforcement where the bullet holes are if the plane made it back. You got to say, where did the bullets hit to stop the plane making it back? You know, and right now we're not recognizing that, you know, we're doing some stupid things in international soccer because we're destroying creativity, you know. But gradually we're starting to see creativity creeping back into the game in England, you know, and we're starting to see English players coming out of the inner city areas, you know, and coming out with creative abilities that we haven't seen for decades, which makes this week's Brazil versus England game all the more intriguing to me.
Oh, you're going to destroy us. We have like 10 guys out with injury.
I knew you'd say that.
Well, you can look at the lineup and it's true.
England got a bunch of players out with injuries as well. But, you know, we're not making excuses. You know, everybody always has people out with injuries. You know, and so, you know, we're in a situation where...
So we have two center backs. Okay, and then we have a first sub.
Brazil doesn't need center backs.
All
Brazil
three are doesn't out. Need center backs. Our starting six is out. Our starting 10 is out. And every.
I got the world's smallest violin here.
Hey, I'm literally 11
Andy,
guy, 11
there
guys
are so
out.
Many guys. At, there are so many guys out in Brazil that they actually called Philippe to see if he'd be available to be called up.
Listen. Hey,
Philippe, do you know what triggered means?
Yeah. Listen. Here's the thing. Back in the days, Brazil's C team would beat England by 4. So now Brazil with 10 guys out, we're going to lose to England by 5. So point being, you're right. But yeah, this week will be tough.
You know, when's the game? I didn't even know that
Saturday. Saturday, I think.
We might have lost by 4 to your C team, but then we'd invade your country and we'd grind you down and we'd take it over. You know, so
is it at Wembley?
I don't know. Is it a Wembley? I think
is
so.
Is it in England? I assume it's in England.
I believe it is.
Yeah. I believe England's the home team. It's going to be really interesting because Brazil isn't the force it was. You know, they're in their longest drought since the 1960s and 70s. You know, and so it's going to be interesting to see how the cultures have changed. This is like Iceland again. We're looking at England is getting somewhat of a creative cultural rebirth. You know, because people have recognised that that's, you know, the missing bullet hole situation. You know, they needed to make the engine work again. You know, and so, and Brazil has gone the other way where, you know, the academies, we've spoken about this, you know, the academies are taking over, they're taking kids off of the streets at age, you know, 11, 12, 13, 14.
Eight.
and then they're corridoring them in some type of a system because they want to win.
Yeah.
You know, and you got to say, we don't want to win.
Yeah.
We just want you to be brave and creative and go for it. And we want you to, as Maslow would put it, with his hierarchy of needs, we want you to transcend. We want you to be that transcendent leader. And here's what I was thinking, and we got to do a podcast on this, because transcendent leadership, you know, look at Leo Messi, because transcendent leadership is not about yourself. Transcendent leadership is about inspiring your whole team, your society, your country, the world. And so compare, and this is the biggest difference between CR7 and Leo Messi, is CR7, it's totally selfish.
It's all about him.
It's all about him. It's about his ego. He hasn't got the maturity as an individual. He wasn't brought up in a soulful family atmosphere like Leo Messi was. He was brought up in a divided family. His dad was alcoholic. And so, you know, he has done amazing. And it's not a criticism of him. Given what he was given, he's been absolutely amazing and fantastic. And he's done some wonderful charitable things. But on the field, he's not prepared to give anybody else the glory. If there's a penalty kick, he doesn't give it to anybody else. Leo Messi does all the time. He can have all the penalty kicks for all the teams he's ever played on. He steps aside and gives that to his teammates. You know, and yet he still leads in assists and goals scored. You know, and so, but Leo Messi is this transcendent leader. You know, he's not doing it for him. He's actually, because of who he is, he does it for everybody. He does it for his country. He does it for his club. He does it for the world. You know, and amazing self-control. He's been intimidated by axe murderers on the field, you know, and he controls himself in the face of all of this intimidation, you know, and, you know, he's a true transcendent leader. That's what we're trying to create here in the Legends Club, is true transcendent leaders that aren't selfish, that in the end up getting way more than the people that are, because people want to work with them. They want to be involved in the orbit of a true, transcendent, unselfish leader.
The takeaway I have here as we wrap up this episode is that, Philippe, if you want Brazil to get back on the level that they need to be a lot more like Messi and Argentina if they're ever going to get to where they need to go. That's the takeaway I've got from this.
No, that's not the takeaway I get from that. Definitely not.
Ooh, you went right to the ego there. You know? I mean, a knife in the heart of the ego.
No, I mean we still.
He can't even take it as a joke. He's got to respond seriously.
No, it's fine.
Yeah, there's people have a way of saying it's fine. That means I'm going to get you later.
Yep. Well, I don't need to.
Watch your back.
I don't need to get, because you guys could cut both your hands and you could show as many World Cups. You guys have. Well, in his case, Euros.
No, zero. He does have a World Cup.
He doesn't have an Euro.
And I always come back to this because Brazil.
They have same amount.
But how many gold cups do you have?
We forgot to say Iceland has the same number of Euro championships than England.
So you know, we come back to this time and again, but you know,
you still won't win anything. Brazil
is not the most successful World Cup country in history. You know, it's Germany, because the men and the women have won combined way more World Cups than Brazil has.
What is their number? Is it six?
It's way more than Brazil.
You know? It's not way more. That'd be one more than Brazil, but but you know, potato patata.
You know, and so, you know, Brazil has a challenge. It's a very male oriented, it's chauvinistic society.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, the women have yet to catch up. You know, and after the Second World War, women in Germany were afforded a lot more equality. You know, as a result of, you know, it being a ridiculously chauvinistic, male-dominated society previously through two world wars. You know, so we have to look at history and we have to relate what happened in history, because while the rest of Europe was waking up to the possibilities of world soccer, Germany was dominated. You know, and so, you know, it, and this makes it overall, I'm not talking from a guy perspective or a girl perspective, overall, Germany has been the better society since the end of the Second World War, probably to grow up in, than any of the other European societies, because it's more egalitarian as a whole in terms of on a big number scale versus Iceland, you know, at 350,000 or whatever population. You know, Germany, with all of their millions, you know, has done a better job. I'm talking about West Germany after the Second World War, because under the Soviet Iron Hand rule, East Germany was a wasteland, was a desert. You know, and so, you know, now, you know, they are, you know, proving through the most egalitarian team sport on the planet, which is soccer, they're proving that their society is actually superior to most societies in the world. You know, Iceland have done it on a small country scale. Germany have done it on a big country scale. And this is what, you know, a lot of countries like England don't recognize, is we've been incredibly chauvinistic over the years. And it's only now that women have got, again, an equal opportunity in the sport of soccer. You know, and we're seeing the power that that's bringing to women's football in England.
We need to wrap up, but Philippe, I have a question for you.
No, I just want to add one thing. The whole fault of Brazil's failure is not Brazil; it's England, and it's true.
Oh, because they're taking all of it.
So we can keep talking about the problems in the Brazil academies in Brazil, whatever. But that's not the issue.
They're sending everybody
just
to Europe.
And he probably won't admit, but I just sent him last week a video of a 15 and a 16-year-old Brazilian, and he was like, "What? Whoa! These two kids are amazing, and they're playing like..."
Well, they look like men.
Yeah,
creative and everything, but at 15
they are already sold to England, yeah. And then at 18 they're going there, they're not ready to play at the EPL level, the physicality and all that yet, and then they start going on loans, they start, oh no, you gotta serve this function here on the team, and they become robots, and they'll play. You see Champions League final, what country has the most nationality? Sure. It's always Brazil. So we still produce the players, but they don't take the next step. Who was the last one who did? The one who stayed until he was 21 years old.
The question I have, though, is, I mean, we're 2 years out from another World Cup. In the Americas, in the United States or North America, Mexico and Canada, does Brazil have a roster that could mature in the next 2 years? They could be back on that stage?
If the older guys, 33, 34, you know, are not injured and they're in shape,
the last thing we need,
they would be good.
Is an English team winning the World Cup on
they're US, not going to win.
On you, US soil. You, that's the last
England,
thing.
England is not going to win.
I have to, you say he won't admit it, and then he actually brings up, you know, and I'm going to use he again because you didn't use my name, so there was a lack of respect there. He won't admit it. You know, but you know, I know that this is happening.
You're stealing all our players and you're ruining them.
I know this is happening. I don't agree with it. You know, I think it would be better off if once again every society was on equal footing to build their own professional leagues. You know, and everybody would do it the way that Brazil used to do it.
You just look at when countries win the World Cups. It's when their own league is at their peak. So you look at France in 2018. That's when PSG was pouring down money, and that was the base for the team. 2014, Bayern Munich had just won the Champions League and had that incredible team. 2010, Spain was the Barcelona and Real Madrid era that they were winning everything. They won the World Cup. 2006, Italy. AC Milan had that unbelievable squad. So it's 2002 was the last time that Brazil had an incredible league in-house.
But
we had
not happening
13.
Anymore because there's so many foreign
it's
players
become so
everywhere.
Global.
So now that doesn't happen anymore. So now the EPL is taking control, but they still can win it.
And with that, we will wrap up what was surely a spirited discussion between Andy and Philippe. And Andy's mad that I'm wrapping this up now. But until next time, when we come back at you next week to discuss more things and have more arguments.
You don't have an answer for that one.
Goodbye, guys.
See ya.